I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The book is called Dead in Tangier. It's a novel set in the 1930s. Its protagonist, Captain Equi, has been forced into exile from Italy after running afoul of the Mussolini regime in Tangier. As a homicide detective, he encounters the unique culture where secrecy and silence are the norms. I'll get the book's author, John Harlan Hughes, who joins me now to tell us as much as he'd like about his novel, the characters therein, and this rich setting. Not only the place of Tangier, but what it was like in 1936 with the Spanish Civil War next door and the looming World War that was to come. John Harlan Hughes has a doctorate in history. He has written nonfiction, including the book House of Tears, Westerners' Adventures in the Islamic World. He is also an educator. The website for more is at johnharlanhughes.com. This new book is the first in a series. It is published by Stone Song Press. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, John Harlan Hughes. Mr. Hughes, good morning.
Good morning, Joe. How are you?
Pretty good yourself.
Fantastic. And happy Victoria Day.
Indeed, indeed. The same to you. What, are you still a teacher?
Yes. I teach part-time at St. George's School here in Vancouver.
Yeah. And so you've done that, I would assume, for a number of years. Is that correct?
I've been at Saints for 25 years, but my teaching, and I use that word very loosely, my career started in the United States, and I continued when I moved back here. So I guess I've been at it for more than 30 years now.
Yeah. Well, was it always a goal of yours to write?
I think I enjoyed writing history earlier. I went down the academic road, but I think this novel and the idea of writing fiction has been in the back of my mind for a long time, and circumstances arose 3 years ago where I had time to write it.
Yeah, and this is a part of the world that you'd lived in, but beyond that, had been very interested in, is that correct?
Yes. I was there when I was very young. We actually lived in Morocco, but really it was subsequent journeys that got me interested in particular in Tangier, which I think is one of the most fascinating places and underrated places anywhere near Europe, let's put it that way.
So when we hear Tangier, and especially in these years, the late 30s, my mind immediately went to Casablanca, because for a lot of people, that's the only, I guess, experience that we have with Morocco in terms of looking at it and sort of seeing what it's all about. Is that comparison apt?
Yeah, and you know, I'm as big a fan as you can be of the movie Casablanca, and I suspect in many ways that the writers who put the movie together had the Tangier International Zone in the back of their mind. Tangier in 1936, when the novel is set, as I've recreated it, was a 375 square kilometer so-called international city, governed by half a dozen European countries, and sort of they included some Moroccan representation. It was, in theory, a kind of neutral zone, and the policeman sleuth of my novel is the Italian contribution to this multinational police force that operated in this very small pocket of territory that was half European and half Muslim in population. So you might say that the movie Casablanca captures some of the basic ideas of neutrality, but not quite neutral, and European and Islamic culture side by side, yes.
Well, when you lived there, obviously it wasn't in the 30s. what was
Thank
it?
Thank you for saying that.
Well, you know, historians, you know, people hear historians on, you know, being interviewed, they think they're historic themselves. the time that you lived there, I mean, was it still sort of the same? Because it's a very unique mindset that you portray in the book, and I'm assuming that's the way it was in the 30s, and as we saw in that movie that I just mentioned, it was like that through the 40s, through the war. Was it still the same in your time?
You know, when I was first there in the early 1970s, we actually lived in an old Spanish colonial town. We lived in Art Deco, essentially Art Deco villas, mm-hmm. that had been where the northern Morocco had been turned into a protectorate by the Spanish. They'd conquered it brutally. Shortly before the setting of the novel, there'd been a very nasty war in that area. So we actually lived in this old colonial villa when I was a kid that still had the same cutlery, china. We actually had this wonderful Berber woman who worked for us, and it would be hard to call her a housekeeper. She was just everything. Mm-hmm. And she had worked for the Spanish who had been there until 1956. So although we were there 20 years later, a lot of the structures of colonial life were still evident. I was very lucky when I went back in the 1990s to meet people in Tangier itself, and perhaps some of the last living people who really remembered the 1930s at the beginning of the international city period. And I really met them by chance. I wasn't there to meet them. I went into a restaurant that was owned by a woman called Mercedes Guita. Her father had been a famous chef in Tangier in the 30s and 40s. And 50s, and she was able to tell me, and people that she brought into the restaurant were able to tell me a lot about the 30s in Tangier, which was a very, just an absolutely amazing time, a very brief time. I should just mention, Joe, that most people who think of Tangier maybe might think of, like, the Beat Generation.
Right.
And got people like Ginsberg and... Burroughs being there. The Tangier that I write about was a very different place. It was still pretty fly-blown. It was exotic. Tourists had discovered it, but it was by no means the kind of glamorous Tangier that happened in the 40s and 50s.
Yeah. So 1936, the specter of war, I mean, that's
right.
Pretty evident there. And then, of course, next door, the Spanish Civil War. Had that broken out yet, by the way?
Well, in the novel, not to give anything away, but it breaks out towards the end.
I see.
And one of the things that drew me to that period is, and that place, is that Tangier was sort of right next to the events that kicked off the real countdown to the Second World War.
Yeah.
There's also, you know, if you switch out the Spanish Civil War for the Syrian Civil War, if you switch out just a few, you know, proper nouns, the mid-1930s really resonates, I think, with me, both as a historian and as a person living now, but I think should resonate with readers who look back and maybe see our own time a little bit in the 30s as well.
Yeah. Well, that's also it's foreboding, isn't it? I mean, if you try to think of what's down the line for us, but for them, did they have in that time in the 1930s? Did they have a sense of just what was ahead in terms of a world war, say?
You know, I think that people are all over in their perceptions of what's going on, and. You know, Hitler had only been in power for 3 years by this point. And my character, of course, is an Italian policeman who is sent from Mussolini's Italy to this neutral zone. And Mussolini, who's sort of you might consider the granddaddy of fascist regimes, he's been in power for a decade and a half back in Italy. And perceptions of him are all over the map. Some people saw him as potentially a stabilizing factor, a counter to the Germans, to the Nazis and Hitler's plans for Europe. I think 1936 is maybe the last year you could kid yourself that there wasn't going to be a major European war. It wasn't clear what side Mussolini was tilting towards. Hitler was still somewhat in awe of Mussolini. And the Spanish Civil War hadn't broken out quite yet. So I think it's at this tipping point, the summer of 1936. Spanish Civil War breaks out in July of 36, in the midst of my book.
Now, Captain Equi, the central character of your book, as you mentioned a moment ago, goes to Tangier. Now, I guess he'd run afoul of the Mussolini regime, is that right?
Well, he's just a little bit too good. You know, there's of course, a bit of a trope here in that he's the good cop working for a bad regime.
Mm.
And I'm really fascinated by, you know, riding around in Italy, which I love to bicycle in Tuscany. And God, that sounds so good to say that, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
But one of the things I've noticed is when you're riding around sometimes on B roads, you'll see these monuments. They'll just be a few people's names on them. And these are partisans, men and women, sometimes very young boys, girls, who were killed by the Germans during the occupation of Italy. And one of the things that got me to write this book was trying to imagine what those people who were not fascists, who didn't agree with Mussolini's regime,
yeah,
what were they doing in the 1930s? Because while many Italians left Italy, a lot of people who were not pro-fascist, who did not hold these values, who liked the Italian, let's call it democracy, before him, what were they doing in the 30s? And that was one of the things that inspired the idea of a policeman who's sort of having looking for opportunities to do the right thing. He does run afoul, of some fascists, and they send him away for a year to kind of keep him out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were many Italians who were just waiting for the opportunity to subvert, to hamper, to push back against the fascists.
So what's he like? I mean, you've given us already a sense of what he's like, what his character is like, and what drives him. Was he a fun character to write for you to create, say?
He was I absolutely loved creating this character, and I guess I should explain that about 3 years ago, I was hit by an unusual form of rheumatoid arthritis, and it meant I couldn't work. It actually meant I couldn't write. And what I actually started to do to distract myself, actually at my wife's suggestion, was to dictate a novel, which turned out to be Dead in Tangier. Typing wasn't possible. I was doing a lot of physio, a lot of exercise, and so I would sort of rant like a crazy man, and dictated this thing through a sensitive microphone, and really didn't know if it would ever become a novel. I don't know if I was trying to write a novel. So Equi got a lot, I think, of the best and the worst of me. You know, he was cycling really saved me, and I know that sounds very dramatic, but just as a distraction from pain and discomfort and creating a way of focusing as I sort of got a handle on this disease.
Yeah.
And so Equi is an avid cyclist, as many Italians were in the mid-1930s. This is some people regard as the great age of cycling.
Yeah.
Unlike me, he's a bit of an aristocrat who refuses to use his title, but he is from a Tuscan gentry or aristocratic family, and he sort of embodies for me sort of some of the best qualities of Italian culture, particularly anti-fascist culture at the time. So there's some of me. Tied up in Equi, and fortunately editors were able to rescue the manuscript from my ranting.
Uh-huh.
But he was a lot of fun to write and create, yes.
And when did you envision a series? Because I understand you're working on a second book now, is that right?
Yeah, well, I think that sort of came to me. I realized after my agent very kindly managed to sort out the publication of this, I think in those conversations, I realized I wanted to tell the story, not just of Equi, but of the world and worlds that he passes through. I think that Italy is so overlooked, its experience in the mid-20th century, its role before World War II and during World War II. There's so many cliches, so many myths about the Italians. that I would like to maybe in my little way fix or remedy by showing Mussolini's Italy in a different light. You know, if there are so many novels and so many great novels by authors like Philip Kerr, Ben Pastor, who have German protagonists.
Uh-huh.
In this period, and I really like the challenge of doing an Italian protagonist.
There are also, other than this Italian protagonist, there are other characters from other parts of Europe, because they all met in Tangier there, or they all congregated
yes.
there. These other characters, I mean, they're Brits and they're French and Portuguese.
Yes.
What was that like to draw these characters out?
I enjoyed it so much, and, you know, I was helped a lot by the historical reality, in that Tangier was what we would now call a classic multicultural community. Most of the characters were at least inspired by people who actually lived and worked in Tangier, either in the administration or in the police. I was very lucky that the last head of the Tangier International Zone CID, who was British, actually wrote an autobiography, a really awful little paperback published in the mid-1950s. And he gave me a great insight of what it was like to work when, these policemen would come sometimes from, you know, one could be an Italian fascist, or a Portuguese fascist, French, British, Belgian. Some of these countries are going to be at war with one another in just a couple of years.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed trying to imagine these people from different places and different backgrounds trying to work together. I think there's lots of lessons or opportunities for lessons. If you had a more gifted writer here, operating in a complex and nuanced world, and one of the detectives is actually the first Muslim or Moroccan detective who's working with the Europeans in Tangier.
Well, what is it like for you as a historian to then create a novel out of what has happened? Is that fun for you as a historian to do that, and yet it remain, I guess, factual in you know, what actually happened at the time?
Yeah, it is fun, in the sense that you're not constrained by the rules. You're sort of filling in between the facts, creating a narrative that I think brings the history far more to life. At least I think it does. You know, I'm very conscious of the fact that there's lots of things about this novel that are no doubt anachronistic, and in the sense that I, as somebody in the 21st century, it's pretty hard for me to get into the head of an Italian in 1936 or a Moroccan in 1936. But I enjoy it a great deal. I mean, one of the things I enjoy most asking my students is the word if, you know. Getting them to try and imagine different scenarios with what we know, from what we know, if things had gone another way. And I absolutely love this process. A friend of mine who I believe you interviewed, John Gray, says that writing a historical novel is something like distressed denim. You know, we all know it's fake, but we're trying to give that sense, that feel, that kind of draws you into another place and time, and I've enjoyed doing that.
Yeah, and you're obviously, because you're working on a follow-up, and this could be a series. There's something there about Equi that really draws you to him, that you're revisiting him again.
Yes, absolutely. You know, as I said, I think what keeps me interested in Equi is that, you know, people in the past didn't stay the same. It's hard for us to realize that they were affected by books, by fashion, by trends, You know, someone who is going to go through World War II, they're going to come out on the other side a different, changed person. And I really want to try and show how someone can be shaped, perhaps traumatized, changed, not only by the big event, but by, you know, what's it like for the people who see, and eventually my character will see, you know, his first television when he visits Germany in the 1930s. We tend to think of people in the past as kind of static, as unchanging. And that, I think, is one of the challenges I'd like to tackle with Equi. If he survives for a few novels, I'd like him to be a different person after the experiences that I drag him through.
No, he is from Tuscany, is that right?
He is, yes.
Yeah, and so you've spent time there.
Yes.
What is what he's left there look like?
Well, you know, my favorite part of Tuscany is called the Val d'Orcia, which is actually a UNESCO region in the center of Italy. It's famous for its wines, of course. Mm-hmm. But in the Val d'Orcia is an estate called La Faccia, and the family who ran it in the 1930s is still there. Just as a kind of, if you're a PBS Masterpiece Theater fan, it's the PBS fantasy of an Italian villa. Mm. In the 1930s, in Equi's day, it was still operating pretty much as it had in the Middle Ages. Essentially, tenants were sharecroppers who gave a certain amount of their produce to the aristocrats or to the landlords. It was very, very hierarchical. It was a very traditional society. Now, La Faccia, which I just mentioned, the family there, the Marchesa, in the 1930s, was actually an Anglo-American. And she's the basis for Equi's mother, who is English. And La Faccia became famous because during World War II, Canadian and British and American POWs who had escaped from Italian POW camps were actually given shelter there during the war. And visiting La Faccia, which is just this beautiful villa with beautiful gardens above the Val d'Orcia, really is what got me thinking about the character of Equi, another sort of milestone after seeing those memorials. Local memorials to partisan fighters, is here was an example of a family who did their best, even before the war, to defy Mussolini's regime in little ways. And really, Equi is kind of a black sheep from a family like that.
What does he look like?
You know, we've had many discussions, and a friend of mine at the book launch said, well, who's going to star, you know, the fantasy?
Right, yeah.
Who's going to play the role? And you know, I think I really didn't visualize him, but suddenly one day a young Daniel Day-Lewis popped into my head.
Mm.
But I think the from the clapping I received at the book launch when a friend asked me this, is I said these days it would probably be Michael Fassbender.
Yeah.
But he would be a hard person, you know, to cast. But he's Italian, you know.
Yeah.
He's 36, 37 by the time of the novel. He's very fit, and this is part of this, you know, Italians were caught up, and we tend to associate this with Nazi Germany, but Italians were caught up in a kind of fitness craze in the 1930s. Mussolini was building health resorts on the coast for kids and others, was pushing cycling. There was this crazy sort of combination of machismo and fitness. But I think a lot of it had to do, in the case of of someone like Equi, and I think I picked up on this reading about other First World War veterans, fitness was a way of getting past the trauma of the war. living with depression and anxiety. Exercise brought focus and transported some of these people who had suffered so much trauma. And Ekwe is a First World War veteran, signed up when he was 16 years old, as young as you could, and saw service on the White Front in the Alps, in the Alpine War. We as Canadians, of course, always think of the Western Front, the mud, the lunar landscape. Most of the First World War for the Italians was fighting at the high altitudes against the Austrians. And Ekwe is really spending his life. One of the reasons he sought out the discipline of the Carabinieri, being a policeman, his pursuit of cycling, has a lot to do with his experiences during the war.
Well, are you as you work on the second novel? Are you still dictating it?
I do actually a bit, not because writing is I have my hands back, I do find that sometimes it just flows better, and then I go back and edit the dictated portion. I'm not doing a lot right now. I'm taking this very slowly, to be honest, Joe. I think I've learned that ranting is not necessarily the best way to produce a novel manuscript.
But you know, you mentioned taking it slow. I mean, this is a character, I guess, that you've brought a lot of your own experience too. I mean, the places that he's places like where the place where Ekwe's from, for example, somewhere that you know, Tangier. Obviously, you'd lived there in the past. I mean, all of these things come to bear, don't they?
They do, absolutely. But you know, I'm we're on the other end of telephones here. But I'm the last person who would be a dashing sleuth in 1936, taking on fascism. I think my innate sense of cowardice and survival would have made me a passionate supporter of any authoritarian. I sometimes worry about that tremendously, how I would have operated. I think, like many Italians, and Mussolini, of course, was very open to the idea of people leaving, of emigrating from Italy and leaving, and I think I completely understand why so many Italians left, as opposed to stay there. I don't know that I would have had the resilience and fortitude, frankly, Joe, to live. One of the things I try and suggest in the novel is that Mussolini, which of course the slang for him was big head, Mussolini's regime was violent. Mm. It was repressive. It was authoritarian. Mr. Putin's regime would look pretty mild compared to Mussolini's in some ways. And I'm not a fan of Mr. Putin. That's not what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But you know, we once again the Nazis tend to become the bar for despicableness and evil, and the fascist regime was violent. It was brutal, and they did execute people in front of and try them in so-called people's tribunal. Thousands of people were executed or put into internal exile by Mussolini's regime before the war. He did prefer to exile and sort of teach his opponents and critics a lesson. But staying in Italy and trying to be subversive was very dangerous.
Yeah.
And you could be killed for it.
Yeah, I'm enjoying the book, as I mentioned to you before we started. But having had this chance to talk to you now about it, I'm going to read it in a sort of different light, in terms of, say, the context of today, and as you said earlier, the lessons that one could derive from the book with regards to what's happening around us. And I think that makes your book particularly special. And as I said, I'm enjoying it already. I'll enjoy it a lot more. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you, John.
Well, this has been a privilege, and it's been great fun, Joe. So I thank you for this opportunity.
Well, you're very welcome, and continued good luck with the book.
Take care. I've appreciated this.
The interview you just heard with John Harlan Hughes was taped just over a week ago. And not long after I got off the phone with John, he sent an email that I just want to read part of. John writes, quote, "I believe I said that the People's Tribunals in Mussolini's Italy executed thousands, which is wrong and misleading. The regime was murderous, violent, thuggish, and repressive against Italians, Libyans, and Ethiopians before World War II, but not in the way I misstated. I suppose in my nervous state I conflated things, for which I apologize." John then goes on to ask if I could edit that part of the interview out. I didn't think it was egregious, nor could be misunderstood, but I did want to read the email from John just to clarify things, especially since it caused some concern to him. I also want to thank John McLaughlin Gray, who was on this program this past fall. He is a friend of John's, and it was his suggestion that Mr. Hughes bring his book to this program to discuss. I enjoyed the chat I had with John Gray this past fall a great deal. I have many happy memories of that, as I have of this interview that we just did with John Harlan Hughes, the author of Dead in Tangier. Stone Song Press is its publisher. John Harlan Hughes, join me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Lanta.